We own this country.
We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Good evening. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio and Culture Vigilante every Wednesday evening here at 7 p.m. I was just realizing today that we are in September. We passed the Labor Day holiday. I hope you all enjoyed some great time with your family and your friends over the weekend. I did. My children were home from school, enjoyed being with them, as I always do. I had a great time with them. But also, now that we're back into the work week and everything's kind of back to normal, we're in September, folks. It's like 2014 is like almost over. The holidays will be here, and the year is almost over. And I think it is 1 week from tomorrow. It'll be September 11th again. And the reason that I bring that up is that I think there are some very interesting dots that need to be connected in the news. Some things that are going on that are not widely broadcast, widely reported on in the news that I kind of want to talk about a little bit tonight here in the opening of the show. And also to kind of bring I think the biggest buzz that's been in the news this week is the fact that Obama has no strategy. And why that's important is we're going to talk about that right now in the next few minutes. Obama has no strategy for dealing with ISIS or anything that's going on over in the Middle East. We've got Russia is, invading the Ukraine, and we're on the verge of God only knows what's going on there. The Middle East is a hotbed of just, it's the biggest mess that I've witnessed in my lifetime. The threat, it's just overwhelming to talk about it. But I kind of want to draw some parallels between the original 9/11 disaster, the things that happened over the last couple of years, Benghazi, and the things that are about to happen now. The first thing I want to talk about is, or bring to your attention is the missing Malaysian plane. Back in March, earlier this year, big deal, a plane just disappeared off the face of Earth. Now we have here in this country, and I'm sure the other countries are as equally as well equipped, we have the capability to spy on anybody doing anything, turn computers on remotely, listen to people through our phones, and get onto our computer files, and the NSA can track us through our through our GPS systems and our phones. I mean, the United States government can really do just about anything that they want to do if they want to do it. I just kind of want to go read over this little article here on CNN that was written on March 13th. As the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines jet entered the sixth day, Thursday, investigators remained uncertain about its whereabouts. Seriously? We've never found the plane. The Boeing 777 took off from Kuala Lumpur, the Malaysian capital, at 12:41 a.m. Sunday, and it was never seen again. The pilots did not indicate any problem with the tower. The passengers, there were 239 people on board, 227 passengers, and 12 crew members. Five of the passengers were younger than 5 years old. Those on board included a number of painters and calligraphers, as well as employees of American Semiconductor Company. According to the airline, the passengers, 14 nationalities spanned from Asia Pacific, Europe, and North America. Passengers from China or Taiwan number to... You know, there's information here about their passports. I mean, this is an old news story. Everybody knows. But to this day, Malaysian Airlines is gone. Nobody knows where it is. Okay? Here's another story we brought to your attention that it was not widely publicized over the last week. This one is in the Daily Mail. Of the missing tank, ship carrying 100 million from sea off the coast of 100 million of crude oil that has been at the center of the dispute over Iraq's billions and it's off the coast of on Thursday. The Kurdish tanker disappeared from the Coast Guard radar screens following a month of legal wrangling over whether it can offload its cargo in the U.S. The integration of Iraq amid mounting violence continues. The semi-autonomous regime in Kurdistan in the north of Iraq is trying to cash in on oil reserves and export its own crude. We have somebody at my door. I'm sorry for that noise. Hermione, that's enough. Iraq, Kurdistan has exported at least 8 million barrels of oil since May, energy experts told Al Arabiya News. But the increasingly weak regime in Baghdad is trying to keep control of its oil billions and says the Kurdish regime cannot sell its oil in the U.S. And it goes on. And the long and the short of it is a tanker full of oil has vanished off the coast of Texas. Unbelievable. Okay, the next thing that we want to put together here. Let's see. There's a couple. Let's see. Visa program. Okay, this was ABC News reported this just on the 2nd of September. Visa program struggles to track missing foreign students. Now, remember, in the original 2011, and with all the border issues that we've had, and all of the threats of ISIS coming across the southern border, the 2011 original terrorist bombing was conducted by people who fell off the radar, immigrants who came into this country, who our national security folks lost track of. Listen to this. This will just shock you. Visa program struggles to track missing foreign students. The Department of Homeland Security has lost track of more than 6,000 foreign nationals who entered the United States on student visas, overstayed their welcome, and essentially vanished, exploiting a security gap that was supposed to be fixed after the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks. My greatest concern is that they could be doing anything, said Peter Edge, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement official who oversees investigations into visa violators. Some of them could be here to do us harm. Homeland Security officials disclosed the breadth of the student visa program in response to ABC News questions submitted as a part of an investigation into persistent complaints about the nation's entry program for students. ABC News found that immigration officials have struggled to keep track of rapidly increasing numbers of foreign students coming to the U.S., now in excess of 1 million each year. The immigration agency's own figures show that 58,000 students overstayed their visas in the past year. Of those, 6,000 were referred to agents for follow-up because they were determined to be of heightened concern. They just disappear, said Senator Tom Colburn of Oklahoma. They get visas and they disappear. Colburn said since the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks, 26 student visa holders have been arrested in the U.S. on terror-related charges. Tightening up the student visa program was one of the major recommendations made by the 9/11 Commission after it was determined that the hijacker who flew Flight 77 into the Pentagon, Hanai Hanjour, had entered the U.S. on a student visa but never showed up for school. Edge said ICE agents are trying to locate every one of the 6,000 missing students, but acknowledged that we really have a lot more work to do to tighten up the student visa program. Despite repeated concerns raised by Congress, federal immigration officials have also continued to grant school certification to accept overseas applicants, even if the schools lack accreditation, state certification, or any obvious measure of academic rigor. So they're just, you know, students are applying for schools, coming over here on student visas to these schools that, you know, are pretty much useless. They're not keeping track of the students, nothing. There are now more than, and will admit anybody because these, you know, they have no accreditation, they have no standards, they'll admit anybody into their schools. Despite repeat concerns raised by Congress, federal immigrations officials have also continued to grant certification to accept overseas applicants, even if the schools lack accreditation. Okay, there are now more than 9,000 schools on the government-approved list. The list includes such top-flight American colleges as Harvard and Yale, but it also includes 86 beauty schools, 36 massage schools, and 9 schools that teach horseshoeing. Horseshoeing! Foreign students can enter the U.S. on a visa to study acupuncture, hair braiding, or join academies that focus on tennis and golf. Once the student arrives in the U.S., it's up to the schools to keep track of the visa holder's whereabouts and report to the government if they repeatedly miss class. This is just amazing. That is a serious concern, Coburn said, because a number of non-for-profit schools appear to have been operating with a primary goal of selling visas, not educating students. Well, duh. We know we have a lot of non-accredited universities that are using this system to bring people in, collect money, and not educate them at all, said Coburn, who is part of a bipartisan group of senators that has been trying to tighten controls on student visas. Tell me, it's a mess. One school on the approved list, Micropower Career Institute, licensed by the state of New York, continues to have 4 campuses on the approved list, even though 5 of the school's top officials, including its president, were indicted on charges of visa fraud in May. According to the indictment, 80% of the foreign students enrolled in Micropower had delinquent attendance, putting them out of compliance with their visas. But the school did not report them, the indictment says. All 5 school officials have pleaded not guilty in the case. ABC News visited Micropower's small 5th-floor campus in a Manhattan office suite, but the school declined to make anyone available to comment. Amazing. I mean, and the story goes on, and it is absolutely amazing that this has taken place. And what's even more amazing is that you didn't hear anything about this anywhere. This has not been reported. I haven't seen this anywhere. I didn't even see this on Fox. Okay, and now the last thing that I want to bring up, let's see. Here we go. This is the icing on the cake, folks. This was reported by the Daily Mail. Let's see, is this the one that I read? Nope, yeah, I already read this one. Oil tanker, missing Malaysian flight, visa program. All of these stories, folks, this is another 9/11 in the making. Okay, we're missing planes. Oh, no, I didn't read this one. Libyan Islamist rebels pose with planes seized from Tripoli airport as U.S. officials warned that they could be used to carry out terrorist attack on 9/11 anniversary. Okay, so people are already predicting that this is going on. This story ran on September 2nd over the holiday when everybody was busy, not watching the news. Libyan terrorists have posted pictures of themselves online posing with some of the airplanes taken from Tripoli Airport after fighters seized it last month. Soldiers from the group Libyan Dawn can be seen climbing on the wings of commercial jets while smiling and waving for the camera. U.S. officials fear that these airplanes could now be used to carry out 9/11-style attacks in the region on the anniversary of the tragedy this month. A total of 11 commercial jets from state-owned carriers Libyan Airlines and Africa Airways went missing in August after militants from the so-called Masked Men Brigade overran the airport. And then, I mean, there are pictures, folks, of these planes, 11 of them, 11 jetliners, and that nobody's got a count of. September 11 not only marks the anniversary of the attacks of the World Trade Center, but it will also be the second anniversary of the raid of the U.S. ambassador's compound in Benghazi, Libya. Okay, so we know September 11th is a big day for Al-Qaeda and Muslim extremists who like to attack America. They've got 6,000 foreign nationals. They don't know where they are, that have come into the country on foreign visas or maybe just, you know, come in through the porous border, the southern border. And there's an oil tanker missing. I mean, it's just scary. And all of this in the wake of two of our journalists being beheaded in the last month. Two American journalists have been beheaded in the last month. And what we don't, what the crux of all of this is, I mean, we've got all of this serious news going on in the last maybe just 2 weeks. You know, a little bit longer, but all of this serious news conglomerating in the last 2 weeks. I had to dig for some of this news. I didn't hear about this news. It's not on the ABC, NBC, CBS. They're not really reporting it that heavily. It's a situation in a little bit over a week. We're going to be commemorating the 9/11 anniversary of multiple terrorist attacks against the U.S. from these known terrorist groups. And what worries me the most, not the fact that we're not having news, you know, the news isn't being reported, not the fact that all of these things are going on, that's scary, but it's the reaction of the public to what's going on. And I want to play this clip real quick to show you how far we've come from 2011 to 2014 and what the change in leadership has done to the tenor and the fervor of Americans in fighting back against terror.
Destroy ISIL so that it's no longer a threat, not just to Iraq, but also the region and to the United States. We can continue to shrink ISIL's sphere of influence, its effectiveness, its financing, its military capabilities, to the point where it is a manageable problem.
It's just frightening. To me, that is just frightening. You know, in 2001, I would have not considered the United States. I thought we had very diverse, and maybe we had some issues, you know, political issues, political division within the country. You know, it was right after George Bush was elected the first time. you know, but the way the country came together, we would not stand, we would not sit still for any attack on Americans on our soil or anywhere else. And the people came together, fervently came together to let the world know that we could not be pushed around. We supported defending America and its principles, everything that went along with it. And now, 6 years into Barack Obama's term, we have a president who stands on a podium and tells us that they want to manage, they want to diminish, it's going to take time, you can't be too hasty. Just days after the second American journalist was beheaded overseas in Iraq. Where's the outrage? Where's the outcry? Where are the people who were willing to defend America 13 years ago? Who were in the streets helping the folks that have suffered losses from the World Trade Center bombings? I don't see that anymore, and we're a little more than a week away from commemorating another year of that first attack, and just a couple of years after the Benghazi attacks. It's just very scary, folks. We need to change some stuff real quick. People need to get engaged because all of the signs point to more of the same. It's very possible we could be looking at larger threats. You know, we never had these kinds of threats when George Bush was in office. I'm not saying George Bush was perfect, but we never saw anything like this when George Bush was in office. And quite frankly, it scares me. And it's something that we all need to prepare ourselves for, because we're almost right there. Okay, we're going to move on, folks. We have a great show planned for you tonight. We're going to Paul Ellison is going to join us in a minute, and we're going to have a nice long chat with him and get some updates on what's been going on in Missouri with the child trafficking issues. We're going to talk about some of the connect the dots with the Ferguson issue a little bit and some other things that have been going on in other parts of the state. And later on, we're going to be joined by Tom Martz of Locke & Smith. We're going to finish our discussion of what might happen in the upcoming veto session. Just very shortly this month, they're going to convene and start their veto session. And we're going to get an update on the St. Charles County Sheriff's Initiative. There's some funny business going on here in St. Charles County. You've heard me talk about it before. A lot of craziness some dirty tricks have been taking place over the last couple of years with the powers that be in this county to take away our duly elected sheriff, and we're going to get an update on that. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back, and we'll talk to Paul Ellison.
It really is time for the people of America to take up Pitchfork.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give
me death.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Ended that segment with some pretty somber warning, you know, just it's a little scary to think about what could be coming down the road here in just a couple of weeks. You know, I have absolutely no faith in our leadership to do the right thing, to help us, you know, to protect us, protect and defend the citizens and the Constitution of the United States. I think those days, that ship has sailed. And, you know, the way I see it, just from the news I've been able to dig up, the threat is bigger than ever. But we also have some issues, too, on a local level. We're going to talk some about local level issues here in Missouri tonight. Paul Ellison has been on with us several times before. He has done amazing, amazing research. He's followed more than one case specifically in the Ozark Lake area region, the Lagares case. There's been a fight for custody of visitation rights for their children. This has not been a story of one man's fight to be able to see his kids. This has really been a story of what the family court system and what the family court system and the inability or it's not the inability, I mean, people are able to, but the way the family court system has been able to maneuver and operate and dismantle families because basically people are not watching what's going on. And this is one man's battle, but it's so typical of what goes on all across the country, in every county, in every state across the country. And tonight Paul is here to give us an update on that. We're going to connect some dots on some other issues too. Thanks for being with me tonight, Paul. I appreciate you coming on. We're going to take our time and get into all the issues tonight.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Lisa. I thank you. It's been a busy summer for me personally. I think I said or kind of you and I had talked off air about the fact that my family moved over the course of the summer. And part of that had to do directly with the ongoing investigation that we've been doing in the Lake of the Ozarks area into child trafficking in Missouri schools. As the summer wore on and the school year got closer, Jackie and I really sat down and made a pretty heavy decision, and that decision being to take our children out of a school district that is well-funded, that has wonderful educational opportunities, that has wonderful extracurricular activities for the kids, and move them into a smaller district where we felt more comfortable with the local control of the school. And in investigating how these cases have kind of worked their way through the last few months, it really was solidified for us when we saw a posting in the Camdenton School District where our children were enrolled to start the fall, where they were looking to hire a DFS liaison to work with the school district in order to go after cases of truancy. And, you know, for most parents out there who have been following what's going on with education in regard to Common Core and some of the other state-mandated changes that are fundamentally affecting school policies, as some of those parents know, the attendance issue in schools is really becoming the key with which to go into any parent's home. I was reminded of why that decision was so important for my family last week when we were contacted by a grandmother with a new case in which her daughter had her two grandchildren in the Lebanon School District, And now keep in mind that school has only been in session about a week and a half for Lebanon today. But she had received a telephone call after taking one of her daughters to the emergency room the night before with a high-grade fever and was there until 1:30. She received a phone call from the child's teacher. And the teacher said, I don't care what the doctor says, you had better pick up her medication and bring her to school or else.
Excuse me.
Exactly.
I thought you weren't supposed to bring your kids to school when they had a fever. They're contagious.
Well, apparently the school district, in addition to deciding that they have the ability to vacate legal orders, they have also apparently absorbed the ability to make diagnosis over the phone in regards to whether or not a kid should or shouldn't be in school. And we talked to this grandmother last Thursday on our show, and Lisa, she read the attendance policy that's in place now for the Lebanon School District. And if you read it verbatim, it's frightening. It's so vaguely worded, and it gives the school such incredible latitude, and it specifically spells out that the school can, at its discretion, involve the Department of Family Services and the prosecuting attorney's office if they find that your child is missing too much school or your excuses aren't good enough. It's just absolutely mind-blowing where we are with that.
Wow. That's amazing.
I mean, it truly is. I mean, it's spelled out specifically, and as we've uncovered in doing this investigation into the Lagares case, you know, the Lagares case is a case where the very same school district, Lebanon School District, which is, I'm going to assume that most listeners might have an idea of how this works in Missouri anyway, but I think they're at least a 5A, or they are a 5A school in relation to athletics at least, which should give some ideas to the size of the school district.
Mm-hmm.
Camdenton is approximately the same size district. These are two of the larger rural schools in our state. And in looking at the Lagares case, it was easy to see that the same law firm represented both Camdenton School and Lebanon School. And you could see their policies taking a dramatic shift to the right as this law firm continued to assert more and more authority that they simply do not have and are not granted. Authorities such as putting in place an attendance policy that gives a school district the discretion to come into your home, regardless of the validity of your excuse, and then refer you to the Department of Family Services or the PA's office for further reprimand. It's ridiculous to think that we're in this situation, and as we look at this legal firm that represents those two districts and see what kind of practices they're codifying and instilling in these districts, we have no choice but to look at the 300-plus other districts across the state of Missouri represented by the law firm of Mikus, Goldman, and O'Toole, one of the largest players in our education game. And unfortunately, as Denny Lagares found out, and as we have audio recording of a meeting in which school administration tells the Lagares's point blank, after rewriting their custody agreement to their liking and disregarding the court-ordered custody agreement after a settled divorce, that if they didn't like it, they could sue. So literally, all of the parents across our state, as these attendance policies become more and more tied to accreditation for school districts, we're going to see more and more of these cases with these vaguely worded attendance policies in order to have the political means. And this is where it gets really kind of scary if you start thinking about it, Lisa. You
mm-hmm.
have the political means then to go after people who dissent from whatever your narrative may be. And that's really what we're seeing in some of these cases. It's people who refuse to go along with the system or ask questions that are being targeted, and then their children are a very real threat, or are very under very real threat.
Your target, right. Wow, that is amazing. Paul. That's amazing. I cannot even imagine what that's like to be dealing with something like that.
Well, you know,
it was truly
a life decision for our family, whether or not to stay in the Camdenton School District. And we learned that this summer they were officially hiring a position that they were saying, this was from the school administrator, the superintendent. He was saying that they had over 200 and I believe 32 cases last year alone, wherein the school believed they had a right to investigate what they term as truancy. Now, 230-something cases in a school Camdenton size may not seem like a lot or sound like a lot, but you're talking about a town with 5,000 people in it that has a satellite reach of maybe another 3,000. I am pretty confident that there's not a severe or real truancy problem there. And yet this is the justification to move forward with this position in order to put real bullets in a very real gun that is a threat against any parent who might even want to rail against this system that's been illegally constructed.
So I sat on a school board for a while. I mean, I had some experience with this. I kind of know what's going on here, why they're going after truancy so hard. And actually, the county where I live in just also put in place a truancy issue, too, where they've, you know, I think the city of St. Charles has initiated a truancy policy as well. It's about money. It's always about money. Mm-hmm. The state awards school districts money for warm bodies in seats at school. So they want those kids, they just want them in school, whether they're sick, whether they're whatever. They want them in school at all costs. And they're getting nasty about it to get the money.
Absolutely right. And now DESE has, you know, started to really tie attendance to accreditation. So in order to ensure that these schools do maintain that money flow, you know, they are making I don't know what the attendance policy used to be in Lebanon, Missouri. But I know now that as it's worded, it essentially says this, that throughout the course of the year, we believe that 12 absences are adequate. Now, I'm not going to argue with that because I'm not finding that to be an unreasonable number by any means. I'm just using that as their example.
Mm-hmm.
But they go on to say that no excuse is, or no reason, including doctor's excuses, is good enough. They go on, the wording is so vague in the attendance policy itself that if the school believes, rightly or wrongly, and it doesn't take an exceeding the 12-day limit, if they believe rightly or wrongly that your student and their absence is somehow disrupting their learning and class flow, and it's tied directly to some of the things you've heard of, Lisa, with Common Core and the Chamber of Commerce, it specifies, actually, in the attendance policy for the school that in order to be good future employees, the Lebanon R3 School District reinforces, pretty aggressively these attendance policies. And they make the very clear statement that no matter what your excuse for your child's absence, those may not be accepted by the school. It's literally at the school's discretion whether or not to accept those.
I mean, I can see another Justina. Yeah, this is another Justina Pelletier case in the making. What if, I mean, I actually have talked to parents who've had custody issues with their kids. You know, they've had custody taken away from their kids because of a school situation, and the kids have been out of school for extended periods of time because of serious illnesses. Something serious has happened to them, you know, and they've exceeded, obviously, whatever the school district thought that it was reasonable. They've had doctor's notes and all of that kind of stuff, and the school is assuming, it's happening. The school is assuming authority and jurisdiction over the parental rights to make decisions on you know, how to care for their kids and whether or not to keep them out of school when they're ill. That's insane. That's insane. I mean, that's just, that's crazy. And they have the legal authority to do it, I guess.
Well, they're assuming that they do. And the assumption of authority that they don't have is really the grossest of all overreaches here. You know, Sherry LaGaris put it best to have it make sense in my head. They get us focused on the egregious overreaches, you know, those things that, like the LaGaris case, the fact that they could actually come into your home and rewrite a custody agreement, essentially. But what really is at the heart of it is the fact that the school functions as a part of the executive branch. It falls under the executive branch of our state government. And
really?
To even write a policy, yes, through DESE, those are all administrative. And basically, for them to even write an attendance policy is against our state constitution, which gives that power to our legislators. So to even institute the policy in the first place is unconstitutional. So there's no limit to the authority they'll try to assume.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm a little confused. Does the state legislature write attendance policies for schools across the state, or do these individual schools write their own attendance policies?
Individual schools are supposed to have local control over those issues. That's a good
That's
point
what you would
for
think.
Our elected school board. That's exactly right, and that's the process that's been thwarted throughout this. You said yourself that you sat on a school board. Did you
right.
happen to attend training as prescribed by the Missouri School Board Association?
Yes, I did.
Did they teach you to keep your head down and do what the administration said?
Pretty much. It was kind of a useless waste of my time and money for the school district to send me on the training.
That is a completely unelected body. They have no standing in our government whatsoever, and yet they have the official title Missouri School Board Association, and all school boards are, it's suggested that all school board members go and attend this training from this group.
It's not suggested, it's the law. You have to
actually, you're right. I'm sorry. You're right about that. That DESE assumed that you needed to go do that.
Right. So you have to go and
How
get DESE.
Crazy is
yeah.
That?
DESE indoctrination, as soon as you're elected to the school board, you have to be indoctrinated over the course of whatever, a weekend or a couple of days, to take this training by the Missouri School Board Association, which is pretty much run by the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, which is run by the teachers union.
Which is also run by, in addition to the teachers union, I would say that it's run by lobbyists in general. No matter how you look at the Common Core equation, no matter which side of the aisle or which side of the ideology you look at, you see that you have the same big-name players, and it doesn't matter whether they claim to be Republican or Democrat. What they are elitists and fascists wanting to take over the structure of education, and the LaGaris case is the end result of that march. That's
Absolutely.
The frightening part of it.
Well, let's talk about
the
LaGaris case. What's going on with the LaGaris case? We haven't heard from them in a while. I know that there was a court date scheduled a little while ago. You know, have there been any developments? Are there any visitation? Was the visitation ever rectified, or did the judge just kick the can down the road again?
It has predictably been dragging on and on with no resolution in any of these areas. Unfortunately, the visit time for Denny the quality of those visits has really degraded. The children are more and more alienated from him throughout the course of this. I'm sure you can imagine being under this sort of visitation system. And being really, these children have been put in a position where they have tried to call out for help, and they have repeatedly been denied that help from Department of Family Services. As far as the most recent updates, if you will, we have started to go through some of the DFS documentation, and those are what's been produced through the legal findings. Denny had requested these, acting as his own counsel many times. His previous lawyer had requested these records many, many times. There's a long paper trail to that effect. And finally, DFS has come forth with these records relating to this particular case with Kyle and Nicole. And it's not so telling what's in those records, Lisa, and this is the part that's just absolutely flabbergasting. It's what's missing from those records that you would never know existed if you didn't have the proof from the other agencies involved. If you were to just look at the Department of Family Services reports and their notes in this case, it would be as though these other issues simply did not exist. We have three separate third-party hotline calls that have been made, that we have documentation for having been made one to law enforcement, which is a mandatory reporter of any such abuse to the Department of Family Services. One of the children was taken there and described acts of physical and potentially sexual abuse. The Laclede County Sheriff's Department, who took this statement and saw the child, claims that they did report or hotline the people named the mother of the child's paramour, boyfriend, who was named by the child as having done this to her. And yet there is no evidence from DFS that reflects that there was ever any call even made from the police to the DFS. To continue that theme, only a couple of months later, there was another call from a doctor. The doctor that the mother initially had gotten for Nicole to see, the doctor made a hotline call to DFS. There is absolutely no record of this hotline call, and this was due to medical neglect issues regarding medications and how they should be administered and how they weren't being properly administered by the girl's mother. And then there was a third instance, yet again, of a doctor who was seeing the children. And I don't want to say the wrong thing, Lisa. I don't have my notebook in front of me. I'm not sure. This is a family counselor of some sort, and I'm not sure if psychologist is the title. But it was a doctor that was seeing the children in that regard. That doctor also made a hotline call to the Department of Family Services, and there is absolutely no record of that either. That's three of these situations that we have proof. We have police records. We have medical records. We have the doctors who say that they made these contacts to the Department of Family Services, and yet the Department of Family Services, in their records that they have been sharing with the school district, with the 26th Judicial Circuit, with local law enforcement, they have been spinning this false narrative and completely omitting these other three hotline instances against the mother and her boyfriend for various reasons in regards to the welfare of these children. And it absolutely makes my stomach flip when I look and see as I was looking at this narrative that they have constructed, completely fabricated out of thin air. It just absolutely makes your stomach flip when you look at the kind of things that these children have been talking and complaining about. The physical abuse in one case, where the boy was beaten or claims to have been beaten with a golf club.
Oh my God!
I mean, it absolutely just breaks your heart and makes you sick all at the same time. And
aren't there statutes against falsifying records?
Oh, sure there are. There are plenty of them. But good luck going to the prosecutor in the Lebanon area to have them prosecute that case. Because if you do that, you'll go to a lawyer named Robert O'Neill, who happens to be the president of the Lebanon School Board, who made the illegal assumption of custody shift in the first place, and who tried to insert himself as GAL in one of these cases in order to protect the school's interest. So best of luck with that whole idea.
That's not incestuous at all. Oh, my God.
No, not remotely. We've been talking on our show this week about some of the connections between Ferguson and the Lake of the Ozarks, and they're not direct connections in any way. I'm not naive enough to think that living in Ferguson, Missouri, is anywhere close to the same as living in the Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri. But what I know to be true is this. The school districts in Ferguson and in some other districts, not just in St. Louis, Hickman Mills comes to mind, others across our state, you know, the way these schools are being used and, you know, in most of these communities, Lisa, as you well know, you have people who are, you know, the people who are on the school board typically are the people who are to some degree politically connected in our county. Now, we can all draw our own conclusions as to whether that's good or bad, but you see this networking or spider webbing, at least at the Lake of the Ozarks, between these corrupt mechanisms, and then you see this militarization of police. You see these arguments that are being made for DFS and other powers to come knocking on your door, and we really all have to scratch our heads and think, you know, I understand that the issues in Ferguson are unique to Ferguson, but we're kind of kidding ourselves if we're not looking around and saying, you know what, we're only a little step away from that here ourselves. With regard to the Lake of the Ozarks, some of the issues that you and I haven't discussed with regard to Lake Ozark, repealing the Constitution essentially over the last couple of years, in eliminating the First and Second Amendments, so that you can't gather in protest. You can't attend public meetings in protest. It's a constitution-free zone in the city limits.
Tell me about the constitution-free zone in the city limits of the Lake of the Ozarks. What?
Sure. Well, you've heard the story about the conceal and carry issue at the Lake of the Ozarks.
No.
At the strip specifically. I think, well, let me see, this has made a little bit of headlines throughout the country a little earlier, a couple of months back. The city of Lake Ozark desired to ban open carry of firearms. They decided to ban the open carry of firearms, this was just recently, because they said that the strip, being a tourist area, which lies in the city limits of Lake Ozark, that would frighten away tourists if people were just allowed to run up and down the street with guns. Well, frankly, that was never a problem, and I had lived at the Lake of the Ozarks area for the better part of 20 years. Never had I even seen anyone other than a policeman with a sidearm. That being said, that was the excuse to use or to restrict open carry, which essentially then makes the city of Lake Ozark one in which you're free to carry your gun, which is your constitutional right, but if you're going to carry your gun, you have to submit to my background check and pay my conceal and carry permit costs.
Of course.
Because you can carry those. You can conceal and carry all day long. You just can't openly carry. Now, I'm scratching my head sitting here thinking, which would you rather have? But that's
me.
We
can have that debate. Yeah, exactly. I mean, neither of conceal and carry and open carry. Open carry and conceal and carry are both constitutional issues. You shouldn't need a permit to do either, and neither
Amen.
and no local municipality should be able to thwart your ability to do either.
No. And that is interesting, just that particular subject, that Lake Ozark has passed the ordinance that prohibits open carry. It's interesting because when you look in Kansas City, shortly after the city council in Lake Ozark was allowed to pass this, even though there was opposition to it, they were allowed to pass this ordinance, which restricted all carry to conceal and carry. The next week or two, Mayor Sly James in Kansas City is pushing for the same thing in Kansas City. Now, to look back at Lake Ozark, this banning of open carry isn't the first time they've tried to rewrite or unwrite the Constitution. They also decided to do that with regards to the First Amendment the year before. They passed an ordinance that essentially said that if the police determine that your speech is offensive and infringes and bothers other people, you can be arrested. But the really frightening part of that isn't just that latitude that it gives to police in regards to arresting someone if they say a bad word. That really carries over into our right to assembly, because it specifically says in that ordinance that any disruption of public business or public meetings or anything like that would also subject the person violating it to arrest, which is, again, in violation of our First Amendment. So I have to look at these ordinances, and I'm not really kidding when I say Lake Ozark has become a constitutionally free zone. It truly has.
Wow. And how's that carrying over? I mean, I cannot understand why people would sit still for that.
Well, you know, I think that they've largely, well, I don't think, I know. Largely, they've been able to do this in a community like the Lake of the Ozarks because of a couple of geographic benefits. Number one, you have a collection, truly, of communities that are, none of which are very big. Osage Beach would be the largest of those on the Lake of the Ozarks itself, and that boasts a population, I think, of somewhere close to 7,000 or 8,000 people off the top of my head. Lake Ozark, the city of Lake Ozark, only has a year-round population of somewhere around 2,000, they say.
Mm-hmm.
Camdenton, 5,000. So you're talking about a collection of satellite communities, and the media there. To say that the media serves as propaganda for the special interest groups at the Lake of the Ozarks would be the biggest understatement I could make. Through a recent election process of the presiding commissioner, it became very clear and evident, and it has been clear and evident, that many of the media outlets are all too willing to cater to their advertisers' interests as opposed to their subscribers' interests. So many of these stories, these incidents that happen, they happen at the Lake of the Ozarks almost in a vacuum, because you don't have media willing to come out and talk about how these ordinances, while popular with people who tend to advertise heavily with the paper or radio station, these ordinances, while they're popular with those folks, they're not so popular for the masses out here. And so they really don't get reported on, and certainly they never get questioned when they are.
Wow. That's just amazing. It's amazing. You guys need a grassroots campaign going down there to overturn the good old boy network that is obviously running the show.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, we have, over the course of the last year and a half to 2 years, we've really managed to bring together a bunch of people who come from completely different spectrums. Some of my dearest friends are people that are really right at the heart of what it means to be conservative and are invested in conservatism and that movement. Other friends that have worked just as hard have come from the complete opposite side of that spectrum and see this constant attack, if you will, of these organized corporate powers, or even locally, the people, the good old boy network, as you say, who are constantly profiting off this same system. We've managed to put together a coalition of people through doing this kind of work that you and I have mm-hmm. done pretty thanklessly for quite a long time. But in doing this, we've been able to educate enough people that this past August, in one of the biggest elections in Camden County at least, the presiding commissioner race, we had an absolutely, completely filthy, dirty presiding commissioner that had it been up to the media at large and the powers that be would have simply been voted back into office as the incumbent. But instead, because we have continued to bring attention to the issues, like the Lagares case, like the things going on with our own sheriff's department and the things in our own courthouse, we were able to send him down in a flaming defeat. And it took a coalition of people from across a lot of different lines, but with a common understanding that it takes all of us to get this done, and we all are on the same page, whether we talk the same language or not.
There you go. Well, Paul, I want to thank you again for your work. Thank you for keeping us updated on the Lagares. Just real quickly, we have to go, but what's with the Lagares case? Where do we stand? Is there another court date? What's the story?
Well, we do have an upcoming court date that I don't have in front of me. But again, as I said, it's really just been a lot of kind of putting off and kicking the can down the road. We do have the Lagares have found a lawyer who's willing to represent them. And so that certainly is a step in the right direction. We are hopeful that we can get a hearing soon. They haven't even tried to go to trial yet. So as soon as I know what day that'll be, you and your listeners will be the first on my list to make aware.
Okay, great. We'll have you back then. Thank you so much. Give my best to the Lagares family, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for coming on.
Will do. Thanks, Lisa.
All right. Take care. You can go to American Spring 2011 to get further updates on that issue, along with all of the other things Paul talked about. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back to talk about the St. Louis County Sheriff's Initiative going on here in St. Charles County. We'll be right back.
You live here?
Yes.
Well, maybe you know what a zombie is.
When a person dies and is buried, it seems there's certain voodoo priests who have the power to bring him back to life.
Horrible.
It's worse than horrible because a zombie has no will of his own. You see them sometimes walking around blindly with dead eyes, following orders, not knowing what they do, not caring.
You mean like Democrats?
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Create a new world order, because the global order is changing again. And the institutions and the rules that worked so well in the post-World War II era for decades, they need to be strengthened.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Hello, this is Lisa Payne Nager. You are listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Culture Vigilante. We're here every Wednesday evening. Various topics of interest for Missouri and people across the country here. While this next subject is specifically targeting one county in Missouri, this is something that is going on a widespread basis in counties all across the country. Again, you've heard me talk about it before. I live in St. Charles County. We had an election in 2012 and narrowly lost the ability for our locally elected sheriff to be the head of our law enforcement here in the county. I think it lost by less than 100 votes. It was put on the ballot at the last minute, within just a couple of weeks of the election, by the county executive and the county council. There was no time. There was no time to go out and really inform the people of on what was really going on, and the ballot language was really misleading. And while a lot of people did a lot of hard work to let folks know about what was really going on, there just wasn't enough time to educate enough folks before the election. And St. Charles County, the sheriff's department fell in St. Charles County in 2012. Well, there has been an initiative to kind of turn that around. There was a petition drive, and there are various other aspects of this to kind of get this back on the ballot, I think, this year. And with us tonight, we have Rodney Zare. He is one of the people that are pounding the pavement, working hard, trying to drum up support to get this issue back on the ballot so folks can revote our sheriff back into authority here, and he's here to give us an update on what's going on. Thank you for being with me tonight, Mr. Zare.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this subject. And you're absolutely correct. This has been a long-drawn process going back to actually around August of 2012. We've been working tirelessly, first of all, to try to defeat their charter amendment, and then to turn around and promote our own charter amendment to restore the sheriff's department with a constitutional sheriff who can basically protect us from, you know, federal intervention. So it's been a very long process. We've done the petition initiative here over the past several months, and unfortunately, at this point, we may have fallen a little bit short on signatures, but we still have found out that under our current charter, we're not sure that anyone can actually comply with the measures of the charter, which requires 10% of the vote in the 2012 gubernatorial election in each of the county council districts. In other words, this would be the number of signatures that we would need to obtain from each of those districts. We have found out that due to redistricting in St. Charles County, the precincts do not anymore align with the districts out here, which causes a problem in that the election authority can no longer tell us how many signatures that we need in each of those county council districts.
Okay, I want to backtrack a little bit and get back to that point. There's a question I want to ask you very specifically about that point, but the reason people, I mean, we're having an issue here in St. Charles County, but the reason people need to pay attention to what's going on here in St. Charles County is because this issue has been going on in other counties across the United States. There has been a movement across the United States to eliminate sheriffs from counties and appoint police chiefs.
That is correct.
Yeah, when you have an appointed police chief, you, the citizen, no longer have the authority or the ability to vote out someone that you don't appreciate how they're doing their job. You know,
and that is absolutely correct. Here in St. Charles County, as of January 1st, 2015, the county executive will appoint the new police chief, and that police chief will report directly to the county executive, and certainly, you know, be a political pawn of the county executive.
Yeah, not to the people. And as we heard in the last segment, which was perfectly outlined in Ozark, Lake Ozark, Missouri, there's a tidy little, cozy little network of politicians and folks that are kind of running their city hall there. It's very tight knit, and you cannot pierce the veil there. And a lot of corruption ensues. And so
absolutely.
The same thing.
And we're seeing the same thing here. And, you know, I think part of our problem here in St. Charles County, and it shouldn't have been a problem, back around 1993 or so, we adopted a St. Charles County charter, which gave us a home rule authority to set up things more or less how we wish. Well, as part of that, and I don't know if we ever anticipated this, we have seen – an erosion of our ability to elect officials in this county. They've gone from elected positions to appointed positions. And basically, we're losing our constitutional rights.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a lot of appointed positions that, the good old boy network here in St. Louis, in St. Charles County is strong. I mean, it's tight and it's very cozy. And now we've lost the biggest law enforcement piece of that to the county executive if we cannot get this issue on the ballot. Now, I want to ask you a specific question about, since the redistricting has thrown a wrench into the works and the specific numbers and the compliance is very muddy right now, is it the fact, are you having problems getting the numbers from the election authority because of the issues with redistricting, or are they refusing to give that information to you? Is there a problem with them?
Well, it's actually a technical issue because of the way that they now count the votes. They don't really do a formal count of the votes per district anymore. And because of this, they basically have to calculate a number anticipating how many people out of each precinct would have voted from a given district, because they do not track those votes by district. Therefore, you know, it's basically a mathematical calculation and not an absolute number. So we've certainly gone round and round with Mr. Krismer out here, the election director, on that issue. And at this point, we're kind of at an impasse. There has been no response from the election authority as to how we're going to address this issue.
Well, is he refusing to comply, or is it just the fact that the foundation has changed?
Well, I would not say he's overtly refusing to comply. It's just that he's not giving us answers, basically, which I guess would say it's noncompliance. But it's definitely a situation where we really cannot move forward with our initiative because we cannot technically comply with the provisions of the charter.
Does he have the authority to challenge the provisions of the charter so that he can give you an answer?
Well, I don't believe that he can. I think this is going to be a situation where they're going to have to sit down and figure out how they're going to solve this issue, because it not only affects and impacts charter amendments as we're trying to go for, it also affects recalls and other situations that are addressed under the charter. So it's not only our initiative, but it could potentially impact any type of initiative petition that we would go after.
Okay, so if in fact the folks that were trying that were pushing this initiative petition, that were gathering signatures, I know you're working very hard for many,
yes,
many months, and I'm assuming the deadline is passed to submit the signatures. Is that true?
That is correct. That deadline would have been August 6th of this year, the day after the primary, and those signatures were submitted to the election authority in the afternoon of August 6th. So we did meet our deadline on getting the signatures there. It's just now a question of how we could comply with the provisions of our charter.
So we don't know if we're short signatures or not because of...
We really don't. You know, although the absolute number looks short, we still cannot get concrete numbers from the election authority to tell us exactly how many signatures we need from each of those council districts.
Okay, so what does that mean now? What is the next step that for us to do? I mean, I'm assuming this is not going to die in the vine here.
It certainly is not going to die. And I think the group behind the initiative petition here is even more energized now. We're certainly would like to have an opportunity to get more signatures. But in the meantime, we have petitioned the county council, all of the council members, trying to solicit their support to put this on the ballot on their own cause and basically on our behalf now, because we really have no means of doing that from what we read, you know, in the county charter. So we have been talking with all of the councilmen. We basically were shut down at the last council meeting. However, for looking and talking to the councilmen, it looks like we do have some support there. It's just that they feel that we've now run out of time to get this on the November ballot.
Well, they put it on the November ballot within a couple of weeks.
Pretty much so.
Election.
Well, we look back on that. And in 2012, it was put on at the last council meeting in August, which means they basically got on there by the skin of their teeth. That date would have passed for us as of the last council meeting here in 2014. So we may have technically missed that deadline. However, we're looking at the fact that we may be able to, if with their permission, go on the April 2015 ballot. Now, all that would require would be some type of injunction to halt the progression and transition of the new county police department until we had a chance to bring it to the vote of the people, and that is basically the avenue that we're pursuing right now.
And so what's the temperature like on that one?
It's pretty heated right now, and we're not sure where this is going to end up. Certainly, you know, it could end up with litigation. We're hoping that we can resolve this just with the county officials without having to resort to that. But again, we're very dead serious about this issue because we think it's a good, you know, looking at across the country, 97% of the counties still have constitutional sheriffs. And we feel that we should be one of those because, obviously, you know, only 3% of the counties have gone that way. And, you know, looking at St. Louis County, and that's all often used as kind of our reference point. Well, St. Louis County is different demographically from St. Charles County. There's a very good reason to have a county police department there because they have 95 municipalities. Most of them are not full-service departments. St. Charles County is just absolutely the opposite because most of our departments are full-service police departments here and can stand by themselves. So, you know, there's not that need for an overarching police department as you would see across the river. So, you know, we're standing by the fact that we need to keep our constitutional sheriff here, and I think we're willing to fight for that.
Okay, what can people do to help? How can we help this position along?
At this juncture, I think the best thing to be done is to contact our seven county councilmen and let them know, you know, what your opinion is on this, because ultimately they're going to be involved in the final decision if this doesn't go to court. So I would really encourage all of our listeners there to go ahead and contact our county council, and actually that can be done with one email by going to council, that's C-O-U-N-C-I-L, at sccmo.org, and that will be distributed to all of our St. Charles County councilmen.
Okay, I thank you. And is there another website? Is the Sheriff's Petition Initiative website still up and running?
Yes, it is. In fact, it's still, believe it or not, gaining a lot of popularity, and that site is at www.sheriffpreservation.org. And we're still getting many hits on there. It's up to, I think, 827 likes. So people are looking at that site every day yet.
Okay, very good. Rodney Zaire, thank you so much for coming on and giving us the update on this issue, and I hope you'll come back and keep us posted. This is really important.
I certainly will, and thank you very much, Lisa.
Thanks. We will be right back, and we're going to talk to Tom Martz from the Locke and Smith Foundation, and we're going to talk veto session stuff and probably some other crazy stuff too along the way. We'll be right back.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for grass fire alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice, combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri.
Our well-being at home and our leadership abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio, and I do want to mention to you, while we are very enthusiastic for folks to join the Missouri Grassroots Coalition .org website, the website's been down for the last several days, and we are working on some technical difficulties. In fact, I think the NSA is working overtime, because my email blew up this last week, and I'm having all kinds of problems with my computer system, too. And I think Facebook went down today for a little while. I was posting for the show today, and I also heard that eBay was having some problems. So if you're having technical difficulties, I'm thinking it's a big conspiracy, and they're all out to get us, folks. But anyway, give us a few days to get the website back up and running, and go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. Join us there. Join us on Facebook and Twitter so that you can keep updated on all these great issues that are happening in Missouri and beyond. And joining us tonight, again, thankfully, happily, is Tom Martz of the Locke & Smith Foundation. We had a nice lengthy conversation last week about the Missouri veto session, and talked about some ridiculous bills that were going to go that went across the governor's desk, and they're going to be kicked back to the Missouri legislature from the House of Representatives. And now we're going to talk about the Senate bills, and I'm sure you've got some interesting things going on flagged for us tonight, Tom. What is coming out of the Senate that needs to be vetoed, or that needs to be overridden from the governor's veto this week?
Well, I find it quite interesting. There are, in the Senate, there were 7 bills that were vetoed because of tax credits, tax exemptions. And then going through the governor's veto letters on those today, it almost seemed like he did a great, or somebody, I'm not saying he did it, but somebody within his office or he himself did a great job in writing basically a cover letter, and then it's almost like they just cut, copied, and pasted the relevant sections that they were discussing into this already formatted veto letter, because all of the veto letters for all these different tax credits and tax exemptions, they all seem to read the same. So It was kind of unusual going through and just looking at these. Now, he makes a couple, you know, it's almost like sometimes when you belong to an organization, like I get emails from Mike Lee, senator from Utah, all the time, and they're addressed directly to me. It says, "Dear Tom," so apparently they have a way of knowing who it's going to, and somehow the letter is already formatted, and Then when it gets sent out, the name's already filled in. Now, he must do this for 100,000 people. Right. So there must be some sort of a program that does that. So it leads me to believe that all these veto letters for all these tax exemptions and tax credits were kind of done the same. Now, the ones that are kind of odd, and I think our veto session might go after these. Senate Bill 493 was a DESE bill, Department of
Elementary and Secondary Education.
Yeah, that's the one. This one actually, it was changing the requirement from the students having to be able to attend school for so many days to hours.
I don't know what
the day requirement is. Let's say it's 50 days. Well, instead of 50 days, you had to go to school for 400 hours or something of that nature. That's what that one was doing. The governor vetoed that one. Should they override it? It really doesn't make a difference. I mean, the Department of DESE is basically the one who sets up all these rules and guidelines. And, you know, I'm at the point now, if a student can pass the end-of-year test at the beginning of the year, let them move up a grade and move on.
Yeah, that's all about... Okay, go ahead.
We
keep stepping on each other. That's all about average daily attendance and money and who we're going to pay, which school districts we're going to pay for the number of hours that they attend school. That,
correct.
That doesn't have anything to do with education.
Right, and I was listening to a member of the Missouri House over in the Boot Heel yesterday. I don't know what program this individual was on, but and I don't know who it was. I wish I could have stayed within the range of that radio station long enough to figure it out or to be told who it was. But the essence of this conversation was that if your child's not in school, well, the school is the best place for your children because that's where they're being educated. And you should make sure that your kid is in school in all the available time frames that school's open to have your kid there. And if your child's not going to be in school, you are required by law to notify us whether or not your kid's going to be in school and where your kid's at. And we are so concerned over your children's safety. I mean, the radio program almost made me want to puke.
Yeah. They just must burn their bridges over people that homeschool their kids or people that have their kids in private schools because they have no control over what's going on.
Yeah, which leads me to believe at some point in time that we'll need a constitutional amendment to home educate.
Yeah, and we know that from following the Common Core stuff, they're after the private schools and the homeschoolers with a vengeance. I mean, they've got their sights set on them, so nothing is safe in that realm. For sure.
That is true. Now, Senate Bill 506, this is one that a lot of the proponents of A1 are fighting against. This is an ag bill. This actually adds deer, captive deer, you know, little like Bambis,
right,
to the definition of livestock that puts them in the ag industry.
Okay, so I want to ask about that because I have heard rumblings that people are trying to raise deer, as in deer farms, raising deer. Why are they doing that? Are they really doing that? Because I'm telling you.
Oh, yeah, excellent. There's actually one that I passed yesterday in the Boot Heel where I saw about, somewhere between 10 to 15 little fawn in a fenced-in area that's probably about maybe an acre, but the fence was like 8 foot tall, so there's no way that the deer could leap out of there. So,
You cannot contain deer. They fly like eagles. They just soar. I live in the St. Louis area, and we've got a deer population problem in most of our suburban areas people are having a terrible time just in their subdivisions, in their neighborhoods. They're hitting them with cars, and they're in their neighborhoods and eating their bushes and shrubbery. And I mean, it's dangerous with all the deer. And people are actually trying to raise deer? Seriously?
Yeah, here in the city of Springfield, we actually have within the city limits a deer hunting season.
Oh, really? And how does that work? Because we kind of need something like that here in St. Louis.
Well, I think it's archery. I don't think you can use a firearm. I think it's an archery season that the city of Springfield has opened up for within the city limits of the city of Springfield during a certain time frame that you can kill deer with bow and arrow, and it's legal at that point in time to kill them because they're, you know, our population of deer within the city limits is like what you just described. I mean, we've got a huge population of deer. The deer are no longer afraid of people. They're basically coming into your backyard and eating your garden and looking at your dogs and basically doing whatever they want, whatever deer do.
And do they hire professional hunters, or can anybody with a license hunt a deer in their own backyard?
Anybody with a license can hunt a deer within the city limits of Springfield.
Well, that is very interesting. And so somebody within the state has decided to raise deer as livestock. I just don't understand that. I'm just dumbfounded by that to begin with. There can't be that much of it going on. So for me to think that there's statute being passed through the legislature to create this special exemption for deer, people raising deer, there's got to be one person with a lot of influence and a lot of money pushed through as a favor from a legislator. Who sponsored that bill?
Maybe, maybe there's some people in the restaurant industry within the state of Missouri who would like to start serving venison as a standard fare for restaurant visitors.
I guess I'm just kind of shocked by that. I can't wrap my mind around that one.
Okay, but that's not all that's in that bill. That bill also contains what's called the Missouri Dairy Revitalization Act, where the University of Missouri is the is supposed to research how much tax revenue is raised within the state of Missouri through the sales of dairy products, and then that money is supposed to be given to the Department of Agriculture. And then there was scholarship programs being created, 80 of them at $5,000 apiece toward tuition as long as you were going into a Missouri college or a Missouri university, and your studies had to be involving ag-related issues. That was that whole entire bill. I really don't see them putting up much of a fight to get that one overridden, but considering our governors of one political party and the majority is of another different political party, they may just try to beat the record that they set last year.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of bureaucracy being created for no reason.
You know, another one which is kind of really odd was a health insurance bill. And the only thing this bill did in reality was that it changed the name from free health clinic to a community health clinic.
I'm kind of losing you there. Your sound is not good.
Okay, well,
hello?
Still. Are you there?
Okay. Yes, that's a little bit better.
Okay, I'm sitting still, so I made sure I
okay, there
before.
You go.
This bill also had to do with the SCHIP program and how much money individuals could make in order to qualify for that program. It was mandating some sort of health exemptions that if the federal government is the one who was funding the health clinic, which almost makes me believe that this was related to abortion clinics, but I won't swear to that because I can't think of any other health clinic that is predominantly and only funded by the federal government.
And what does it do specifically?
It was a bill that was involving health insurance. And basically the legislature was trying to change the name from free health clinic to a community health clinic. And they were changing the aspect of every service is free to that it's based on your income. So if you went in there and you had a job, then you would be required to pay a percentage of your services based on your availability to pay instead of it just being free.
And why would the governor veto that?
I have no clue of why it is that the governor vetoed. I mean, I read his veto letter, but his veto letter in reality didn't make sense to what it was that I was looking at, because most of the bill is already law. A lot of what it is that he vetoed were just little changes that the legislature was making in it, and I think the one thing that he pointed out in his veto letter was that he didn't like the aspect of the requirement that people who could afford to pay have to pay. He wanted to maintain that the free health clinic would be, in fact, a free health clinic for anyone who walked into it.
The kind of figures. Okay. So he's showing his stripes.
Now the one that I think the legislature will go after wholeheartedly is this one, Senate Bill 523. This was a great bill by Ed Enright, and this prohibited school districts from monitoring children with RFID chips in their ID tags. For the schools to be able to track the children after they leave school with the RFID chips that were installed in these IDs, if they were in the IDs, and the governor vetoed out. All under the auspices of it's for the safety of the children.
Right. So that was kind of a common core. It sounded like one of the common core bills that went through.
And it was actually a great piece of legislation, but it was it didn't take him long to hammer that one into the ground.
Wow. And Ed Emery, you say, sponsored that bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Senate Bill 523, a great piece of legislation.
Ooh, we've got to keep our eye on that one. Awesome.
So I hope the House and the Senate gets it in gear and they override the veto on that one.
Yeah, we'll keep a special eye on that one. And I'm sure the folks at Missouri Coalition Against Common Core are probably watching that one pretty closely as well. Wow. So does that about wrap it up for the Senate bills? Or?
No, there's quite a few more. He vetoed 656, which is the one that allowed for school protection officers. But if I'm not mistaken, on our Friday morning radio show that we do down here in Springfield, my co-host, John Lilly, who is a Willard school board member, keeps saying that the school boards have the authority to do this anyway. So I'm trying to figure out why it is that the legislature keeps trying to put this into a state statute if the school boards already have the authority to install or to instill a teacher as a school protection officer.
Oh, because it makes great campaign fodder. That's probably what it sounds like to me.
It does if John Lilly's correct. And I swear every time this conversation comes up, he always makes the comment that the school boards already have this authority. So, therefore, this trying to put this in state statute is senseless because the permission to do this is already within the confines of whoever regulates school boards across the state.
What was the governor's objection to it?
I didn't read his veto letter on this one, but I would imagine it has to do with the fact that schools should be safe, children should be safe, but the way to do it is not to create an administrative person or a teacher with the availability of carrying a concealed weapon within the confines of the school.
Okay. Do you know offhand, just out of curiosity, kind of getting not too far off the track here, but, I mean, so we probably should talk to John, and it's been a long time since I've been on a school board, but can teachers carry weapons into schools individually?
As long as they have been granted the authority through the school board, according to Dr. John, yes.
So any teacher, you could have several teachers in any given school with a concealed carry weapon at any given time, if
correct.
The school policies allow.
Correct. Now, there may be schools across the state that don't allow it, too, but that's each individual school district's, and that's also the parents of the kids who attend that school district. Everyone wants to talk about local control.
Direct their school board as to whether or not they wanted that kind of a program in their school.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Now, here's another one I'd like to see overridden, and it's Senate Bill 673. And Senate Bill 673 was going to change the formula by which unemployment is paid out. Now, granted, unemployment is so anti-constitutional, it's not even funny. There's no mechanism within either the state constitution or the federal constitution for the program of unemployment to exist.
Really?
But the problem is unemployment already exists under the color of statute on the federal level and the state level. And what this Senate Bill 673 was going to do, it was changing the formula by which you were allowed to collect unemployment for how long and how much. And basically it was going to drop the availability of people to being able to collect it for 20 weeks down to 13 weeks. And the governor's veto letter discussed that the bill didn't take into account the money earning possibilities within different regions of the state. and it's cutting people back. It was reducing the amount of money that they were able to achieve through unemployment. It's going to cost them a hardship because they can only collect it 13 weeks if this is passed versus 20 weeks if they just leave it alone. I mean, much of the bill that we looked at on this is already law. We were just making our basis on the changes, and I think this is a Will Krause bill, and the changes were actually limiting the size, scope, and power of government, which to us makes it an acceptable piece of legislation. Yes.
So I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there are federal statutes for collecting unemployment, because don't you get 99 weeks of unemployment versus, you know, per federal law?
Yes, as per the federal government, yeah, I do believe it is 99 weeks.
Is that for federal employees only, or is that, how does that work?
No, I think that law was passed. I think that law was passed and mandated to the states, if I'm not mistaken, but I don't know for how long that was mandated to the states.
And so why would a 13- or 20-week Missouri law be relevant in any case if we have a 99-week federal law for unemployment?
Well, because as soon as that law goes by the wayside, then this law would kick in, kind of like the law that we were discussing last week that prohibits the act of abortion in the state of Missouri. Well, federal law, because of Roe v. Wade, allows it. And once, if Roe v. Wade were to ever go by the wayside, then this statute that's already within the confines of the revised statutes of Missouri would kick in. And I'm thinking this is the same type of scenario.
Okay. It's their plan B.
Correct.
Okay. I got it. All right. So 13 weeks, that's pretty bold. Let's go Will Krause.
Yeah, now there was also a charter school. Matter of fact, the first one I talked about, that was the other thing I wanted to talk about. Senate Bill 493, the one that changed the requirement from days to hours, also implemented charter schools. And you know who is a fan of charter schools in the state of Missouri.
You betcha.
And that was the pretty much the basis for that whole veto letter, was how the charter schools were going to be implemented, how they were going to be set up, who was going to be in charge of them and control them, and on and on and on and on and on.
So it might be kind of interesting to go do a search to see how much money Jay Nixon has received from Rex Sinkfield.
I'm not even going to go there.
Okay, we'll move on. Go ahead.
Okay, here was an interesting one. Tax exemptions for vapor cigarettes.
Oh, okay.
Now,
you're
basically,
gonna have to sell this one to me.
The vapor cigarettes aren't in reality a tobacco product, but yet they're being taxed like a tobacco product. So basically, this piece of legislation was removing the vapor cigarettes from the tobacco product taxation files and putting it under the normal auspices of a commodity that's bought and sold, and putting it under the normal taxing realm.
So, how did they ever get the authority to tax them if they're not a tobacco product in the first place?
Well, I don't know how they got included in there to begin with, unless when they came on the market, that is automatically where they put them, because the governor makes the comment in his veto letter that the vapor cigarettes, they look like a cigarette, they kind of smoke like a cigarette, and because they give the user the same end drug, which is nicotine, into their system, ergo that makes them a tobacco product, and he wants them to remain within the tobacco product realm taxing authority.
Oh, okay. So the Republicans are trying to take it out of the tax, and the governor's trying to keep the tax rolling.
Yeah, currently I believe it is when you buy a vapor, or you buy anything vapor-related, it's taxed as a tobacco product, and the legislature was trying to remove it from the tobacco tax application and just put it under the realm of a normal run-of-the-mill counter product. I mean, the sales tax would still be being collected on it. It's just the manner in which how much sales tax would be being collected on it, because cigarettes are taxed at a higher rate than normal commodities. And he also used a portion of his tax exemption vetoes in this, too, that it would be costing the state way too much money in order to exempt this product from taxation and, you know, yada, yada. If you haven't had the opportunity, go read one of the tax exemption veto letters. It's quite interesting.
It's all about the money. Follow the money.
All about the money. Another one is the it's a bill that was for short-term loan lenders. The legislature was basically, it wasn't exempting them from taxation, but it was basically, it was setting them up as a one shop. They have to comply with the Missouri state laws. Right now, a lot of the local municipalities like charter cities, charter counties, Kansas City and St. Louis, they have completely taken that aspect of local control to a whole new level, and they have started regulating these short-term loan lenders to the point where, you know, they can't compete in certain areas of the state because they're so heavily regulated by the local governing board. And basically the legislature was trying to make it so that a one-size-fits-all regulation for these businesses throughout the state of Missouri, kind of like they were doing with the cell phone towers from earlier this year and last year. And the governor vetoed it because basically he said the Kansas City has very harsh, strict guidelines on businesses that make these kind of loans, and that you would be usurping their authority to have that local control, and that if you set up a one-stop shop, state of Missouri type one guideline meets all requirements, that you were usurping the local authority of all the different municipalities throughout the state of Missouri.
The governor was doing a small government thing. Sounds like they need to leave that one alone.
Well, he was making that basis of local controls and everything else, but you know, I'm not too sure that local governments should have that much authority to regulate a business either in or out of business in that manner.
But you certainly don't want the state to regulate it.
Well, you don't want the state to do it either, but if you're going to have a business that's statewide, would you rather have them being basically reporting to one authority that makes all the rules, or would you have them reporting to 900,000 different authorities who have written 150 million different laws that they have to comply with?
Well, that means that a local lending authority or a local lending business would set up business in a municipality that was friendly to their business, and they could set up in Kansas City and not set up in Springfield, as it worked out. If Springfield didn't want small lending institutions there, they would make charters not allowing that. I mean, I'm not sure I'm following you. Explain it to me.
Well, see, like in Springfield, we've got 9 people who rule the city. Those 9 people don't speak for the 158,000 residents that are in the city.
Right.
So when they make laws like this, they're, oh, we're doing it under the guise of the consent of the governed because they elected us to do that. Or they elected us to govern in this manner. No, we didn't. We elected you to govern in a manner which benefits the city of Springfield and benefits the people of Springfield. When you start setting up guidelines by which businesses don't want to locate here, you're not governed under you're not governing under the consent of the governed anymore. You're governing under the consent of the people who sit on city council and those who work for the city.
But it's easier to kick out a city council member than it is to kick out a state legislator, and you don't want businesses having to bow and scrape to the state legislature for their authority to come into the state.
I don't want business leaders to have to scrape and bow and kiss anyone's rear end to locate in the city of Springfield either. But living in the city of Springfield, I see it far too often.
So does this piece of legislation, I'm not sure, what does this piece of legislation do to keep government out of businesses, I guess, is the question that I have.
Based on the way the changes to this current law was written, it was just basically setting up a guideline by which these businesses can exist, or actually a guideline by which these businesses do exist, but at the same time it was basically telling all the thousands of municipalities in the state of Missouri that these are the guidelines by which you can write laws to govern these types of businesses.
But that's kind of big government.
It is kind of big government, but in some essences, it's a whole, kind of like the cell phone bill. You know, I don't want Verizon or Sprint or whoever, when they come into the state of Missouri, to have to comply with 9,000 different municipalities just because they want to put a cell phone tower up.
Why would they have to comply with 9,000 to put one cell phone tower up?
Well, I mean, wherever they're putting this tower, like
they would just
have
to comply with one.
Was right, but the city of Springfield could have very harsh restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, city of Springfield's a great place to put a cell phone tower because we got the population base. We're sitting up on a plateau. The signal can last a whole lot longer. And all of a sudden, the city of Springfield is going to say, you know, we really don't want that cell phone tower. Well, in reality, it's not the city of Springfield who's saying it. It's the nine people who are sitting on city council.
Well, then you vote those guys out. Yeah, you vote out those guys because they are not doing right by bringing the right kind of business.
It doesn't happen, Lisa.
Well, I know, but it's not going to happen on the state level either.
It happens in no level. The problem is these people have so much authority and so much power to write any rule and regulation that they feel fit in writing, nobody can stop them.
Oh, we agree on that point totally.
Problem.
But if you have a piece of legislation that overrules local municipalities, that's big government as well, yes? And that's not a good thing either. Unless that piece of legislation opens it up.
Can the city of Springfield exist without the state of Missouri?
I think it could.
I don't believe it can.
Why
take
not?
Away the interstate highway system and all the U.S. highways, and the city of Springfield, does it continue to operate without the state of Missouri? It does not. It collapses in on itself. Because you have no way in, no way out.
But the city of Springfield can generate its own revenue. It can take care of its own infrastructure. I think we're kind of talking about different things here.
Well, no. See, the city of Springfield cannot. I mean, it can defend for itself for a while, but which requires the state of Missouri to be there. The city of Springfield, literally, if it had to rely on farmers and ranchers within the city limits of Springfield, there would be 157,000 people starving to death.
Okay, I understand your point, but it's the state's job to take care of infrastructure, roads, yada, yada, yada. It's not the state's job to dictate local city charter type things, you know, local business area issues. So I think it's an overreach of the state government to say what the city of Springfield can and cannot allow as far as businesses moving into your municipality?
Well, I think it's an overreach of city council to do the same thing.
I would agree. But the theory is, at least, that it's easier or more effective or probably more possible to vote out a city council member or a city council executive or whatever than it is to overturn a state legislature. So,
well, that was true when we were a republic, but now that we're a democracy, mob rules.
Well, that you'll get no argument from with me.
I mean, we rejected this piece of legislation from the get-go.
Uh-huh.
But I just found it interesting that the changes that were being made to it were basically because municipalities were setting themselves up as being the strong arm of tyranny to try to prevent these businesses from locating, and they're basically trying to set these businesses up to the point where they cannot compete in what we call a free market, which we know does not exist either.
Right. Okay.
Kind of like the payday loans. You know, this isn't a bank and it's not a credit union. I don't know what these companies are, but they're also not payday loans either.
Yeah, it's kind of a loan shark business, I think. A legalized loan shark.
Yeah, but we know you can't be a loan shark because that's illegal. There's laws against that.
Well, unless you're a payday loan.
Yeah, I can't legally loan you $100,000 and then tell you in 30 days you have to give me back $110,000.
Right. But unless you incorporate, then you can.
Correct. And then I have to comply with 9,000 different municipalities throughout the state of Missouri.
Okay, there you go. All right, Tom, we're running out of time, and I know we ran out of time last time too, but thank you for coming on with us. I'm assuming that the great folks at Locke & Smith are getting along very, very nicely with their scoring, and we're going to have a nice list of names here to award the granite plaques to very soon.
We have 6 more votes to score, and that's it.
Okay. So possibly when will you guys again announce the finalists for the awards?
We are going to announce the week of Constitution Day, which is September the 17th. So I think that's a Wednesday. So September the 19th, we will announce it on our Friday morning radio show here in the local area. And then after that, we are free and open to announce it whenever, wherever, and including the open and closed Facebook pages.
Okay, very good. LockeAndSmithFoundation.org, yes?
Or LockeAndSmith.com with Lock spelled with an E.
Okay, LockeAndSmith.com. I'm sorry, I never can remember which one. Tom, thanks for coming on with me. We'll talk to you again
soon.
Thank you. Okay, have a good evening.
All right, have a good evening.
Thanks.
All right, bye.
Okay, that does about wrap it up. We have just a couple of minutes left of the show. There were a few more things I wanted to get to tonight, but we didn't have time. Wanted to make sure that you check back with our MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org webpage. We'll have that back up and running again. If we don't have it up and running, go to our Facebook page. You can follow me, Lisa Payne Nager, Culture Vigilante, on Facebook and Twitter. And check out Cynthia Davis on Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. and Dave Court on Fridays and Saturdays. We'll be back here again next week, Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, Culture Vigilante, Missouri Grassroots Radio. Thanks for being with me. Good night.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.
My.